In the coming week, a flurry of in-person summitry. World leaders meet in the UK for a G7 summit. NATO and then EU leaders meet with President Biden in Brussels, and Biden sits down with President Putin in Geneva. It's June 10th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Sebastian Mallaby, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Sebastian is the Paul A. Volcker Senior Fellow for International Economics at CFR, and he joins us from London. Sebastian, always a pleasure forecasting with you.
Likewise. Thanks, Bob.
Well, Sebastian, all the action is on your end as we kick off this summit-packed episode of The World Next Week. As we are taping this on a Thursday morning U.S. East Coast time, President Biden and Prime Minister Johnson have already met and agreed to an Atlantic charter. So what's this about, Sebastian?
Well, I'm looking at the BBC website right now, hoping for the latest of the latest of the updates. And I can tell you, Bob, that it's not that exciting. The president is quoted as saying, "It's gorgeous. I don't want to go home." Diplomatic, perhaps. Substantive, not so much. But perhaps what President Biden doesn't know, just to pursue this little thread for a second, is that Cornwall, where he is meeting Prime Minister Boris Johnson and where the Group of Seven summit kicks off tomorrow, is in fact a place where the locals are famously hostile to outside visitors who might be bringing coronavirus. There was a whole thing about this during the past 18 months or so of pandemic. And so I'm just hoping, as somebody who identifies both as American and as British, that my British Cornwall compatriots will show more hospitality and respect to their American visitor than they do sometimes to visitors from London. But that's the trivia. On the substance, you're right, Bob. Atlantic Charter, that's what they're announcing. That's sort of a riff on the 1941 agreement between FDR and Winston Churchill during the Second World War, laying out sort of broad principles for how the post-war liberal order might look. And of course, that's kind of a relevant theme today because we're looking at a world where the liberal order seems to be under threat, both from Russia, from China. We'll get to those things later. So in terms of the symbolism, Atlantic Charter has a clear resonance. On the substance, though, of the relationship between President Biden and Prime Minister Boris Johnson, there's one big sticking point, and it's not playing so well to the mood music of cooperation and happy meeting. And that is Ireland, because President Biden is very clear that he wants nothing to upset the delicate peace in Northern Ireland and along the border between North and South. And of course, the hangover from the Brexit negotiations and the fact of Brexit is that positioning the border now that the North and the South, you know, one is in Britain and the other, Southern Ireland, is in the European Union. With Britain having left the European Union, that complicates how you manage the border. And that issue still has not been resolved, really. The UK government is dragging its feet on implementing things that it promised to do as part of the Brexit deal. And that's causing tension in Northern Ireland. And I think President Biden is concerned about that. And that's a bit of a sore point in the UK-US relationship right now.
And I'll just add, is that the concern that the longer this remains unresolved, you could have the resurfacing of the tensions in Northern Ireland between the loyalists and those who are pro-UK and those who identify more with the Catholic South? And is this going to be something that burbles up again?
Yeah, I mean, it's burbled up already a bit. In the last few months, there have been periods of violence initiated actually by the Protestant side in Northern Ireland, who are protesting bitterly against the idea of having customs checks between Northern Ireland and mainland Britain. In order not to have checks on the inter-Irish border, you need to have checks somewhere else. And so the idea is sort of in the Irish Sea, and that would obviate the need to check things as they move across from Northern Ireland to Southern Ireland. But then the drawback of that is that you're kind of separating one part of the United Kingdom, Northern Ireland, from other parts, namely mainland Britain. And to anyone who is sensitive about the solidity of that United Kingdom unity, that's a red flag. And so you've had these violent protests from the Protestant Northern Irish, and it's just not clear politically how that needle can be threaded. Because on the one hand, if you try to have checks on the inter-Irish border on goods, that would be massively disruptive. If you have them in the Irish Sea, the Protestants get upset. There's no solution.
All right. So we'll see how they handle this or potentially fudge it in the wrap-up of this particular summit. But then they head into the broader summit here, the G7, the first G7 meeting in the post-Brexit era. Biden has famously said and repeatedly said the U.S. is back. There's going to be a lot of sort of watching how different this is from Trump-era summits. But can you give us a sense of what we should be looking for, Sebastian? Preston, you made a passing reference previously to the concerns about coronavirus. It seems like virus vaccine announcements are going to be a big feature of this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing to say about this summit is that, you know, it's Mr. Biden's first foreign trip as president, and it's being pitched as, you know, part of a very, very big idea, which is the preservation of that liberal global order, which the US and its allies created at the end of World War II and now seems to be under threat. And under that kind of big frame, as we'll get to earlier in the podcast, there's the G7 summit kicking off tomorrow, Friday, and then following on that, two other summits. So it's all part of a big frame. And I think the symbolism is not to be sniffed at, by the way. I mean, I think the gathering together of the G7 leaders in person, some of them haven't met before, and then the inclusion of three important Asian democracies amongst the invited group. So the leaders of Australia, South Korea, and India have been invited as well to kind of create that, what some people call the D10, the Democratic 10. Bringing those groups together is symbolically important, and also practically in the sense that if you want the democracies to work together, first of all, the leaders of the governments and the staff officials of the governments need to even meet each other and know each other a bit. You can't work together very easily unless you have some kind of relationship and mutual trust. And so I think this process is useful in building that. But then when you get to the specifics, like you mentioned, Bob, coronavirus vaccines and donating vaccines to the COVAX, this global mechanism to distribute vaccines to the poorer countries who don't have access, I think that's where, you know, the cynicism starts, because, you know, there's something like 6 billion or whatever it is, people who are yet to be vaccinated. I mean, it's a huge number. The US is promising to donate 500 million vaccines. If everybody needs two doses, you can see that that's just a pretty small down payment. And as some people are arguing, you know, it would take, on the International Monetary Fund's estimates, just around $50 billion to pay for vaccines that would cover 70% of the world's people and deliver an economic benefit of $9 trillion by 2025. So the cost benefit is just massively in favor of huge and determined action. I don't think we're seeing that. I think we're seeing a rather tokenistic down payment, not a full-fledged, full-throated support for a grand mission. So I think there is this gap between the grand idea of the liberal order and the reality.
Sebastian, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, just taking a quick step back, on the G7 and previous summits. I mean, the G7 has for a number of years now been talked about as an organization that's increasingly seen as outmoded. It's been superseded in relevance, seemingly, by the G20, a group of nations that better reflects the emerging and most developed economies in the world. The G7, though, has had in its history some big signature moments and taken steps that have played a role in the world. Does it have the capacity at this stage and at this moment in sort of history to do anything, whether it's on vaccines or others, that could be significant, whether it's symbolic or substantive?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, the sort of endless search for the perfect G, you know, is going to be endless, right? So there was this moment when the G20 was created,
right,
and that was billed as a better alternative. But then you realize that, you know, there are some countries in there which pretty quickly after being invited, you know, people think, whoops, you know, why did we invite Argentina? When the economy, soon after the creation of the G20, I think shrunk considerably. And then you've got other examples of just countries that either should be in some group or should not be in some group. And that's always going to be the case, because obviously the weighting and the political orientation of countries changes over time. I mean, one thing coming up in the next few days, President Biden is a meeting with Turkey's leader Erdogan, who of course is leading a country which is a member of NATO, but is at the same time a bit of a thorn in the side for the West in terms of his populist authoritarian direction. So, you know, you're never going to have the perfect grouping. So I think the answer to your question, Bob, is some sort of flexibility and willingness to run a lot of different meetings is the key to the international system. You have the G7, you have the G20, you don't give up on either. At the same time, you know, you can do some things through the OECD negotiations, some things through World Bank or IMF coordination. It's putting together these different things, which I think gets you to a successful diplomatic posture.
And at the very least, you've got a U.S. president now who's a booster of this approach, of the multilateral approach. You don't have President Trump, who was famously skeptical of a lot of these organizations and pointed to them, whether it was NATO or even places like the G7 or G20, as kind of free riders on the U.S. beneficence and taking advantage of the U.S. and had created a good deal of friction among erstwhile U.S. allies. You have, again, President Biden saying, let's work together on whatever the issue is. And as you say, it could be the vaccine gestures might at this point seem tokenistic, but it's the U.S. working within the system and not sort of antagonistic towards the WHO or what have you.
Yeah, there was a moment when people talked about the G6 plus one. That was because President Trump in 2018 actually refused to sign the G7 communique and, you know, left Canada having had a bust up with Canada's leader. So, I mean, that really was a moment when the G7 appeared to be especially useless because the biggest member was insulting all the others. And at least we've put that behind us.
All right. So we'll look to see what comes out of Cornwall. And certainly, as always, we'll look to see what the photo op yields, Sebastian.
You know, Bob, another area where there's contrast between a United States led by President Trump and one led by President Biden is NATO. So I'd love to ask you about the next leg of President Biden's trip to Europe. After the UK, he'll be going on to Brussels, and there'll be the summit, first of all, with NATO, and then with the next day with the EU. On NATO, Bob, what do you think we need to know, and what should we be watching?
There's an enormous summit agenda, actually, especially if you follow the comments that the NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg said in his visit to Washington earlier this week. But there are a couple of big areas to watch in particular. First of all, as Stoltenberg has said, they're sort of christening this summit in the NATO 2030 agenda, which is sort of code for the NATO coming into the future and modernizing and investing more, addressing issues of what he's calling resilience technology. And the investing theme is something that Stoltenberg has been touching on prior to Trump, during Trump. He actually very skillfully worked with President Trump on his sort of overt nudging of alliance members to pay the 2% commitment of GDP towards defense spending. So we'll see a lot about this sort of NATO, you know, bringing NATO into the future. But what does that mean in concrete terms? Well, first of all, the largest ever deployment of NATO was in Afghanistan. At one point, collectively, something like 100,000 troops were there. It started out this year more like 10,000. And now with the U.S. announcement of the drawdown, both NATO and U.S. forces are halfway towards their full drawdown announced, which is supposed to take place fully by 9/11, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. It's a little bit of a sore point, however, because the Biden announcement came as a surprise to a number of NATO members. You've heard this from Germany and some other countries. I think they're going to want to talk to the U.S. about being in sync as things start to get more and more difficult. There's a great deal of concern that the Taliban are going to kind of move into a security vacuum and start taking over major Afghan cities. So I think you'll see NATO talking about what kind of funding they're going to have for Afghan security forces, what kind of training, what kind of contingencies for moving against any sort of Taliban surges. So is there going to be some step up in, you know, bombing campaigns if you have, say, you know, Taliban forces massing outside of Kabul or some other place? You know, they're talking about boosting infrastructure, you know, airport and so on, diplomatic compounds. So you can see a lot about, I think, a lot of discussion about what's the next phase in Afghanistan. And obviously, as always, there's going to be a great deal of talk about Russia, what it means to deal with, you know, Russia's posturing. Obviously, it's the aftermath of the 2014 annexation of Crimea. Stoltenberg has said there's basically been the biggest reinforcement of collective defense in the eastern portion of the alliance since the end of the Cold War. There are something like four combat battle groups in the eastern countries of the alliance, in the Baltics and so on. And there is what they call air policing, where they're fending off, you know, sort of Russian incursions into allied airspace. They've increased the presence in the Black Sea, in the Baltic Sea, and also cyber defenses. Russia has really, I think, caught the alliance members off guards in the last several years in their ability to hack into elections and all sorts of other things and critical infrastructure. I think there's going to be a great deal of discussion about how to counter that. They've already taken a number of steps, but really how to counter that and then maybe counteract in cyber ways or otherwise. So that's going to be a really big set of discussions. And then you referenced it earlier, sort of as a sideline to the NATO summit, will be the U.S.-Turkey summit. So Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Biden, and then it's expected to be a pretty difficult conversation. Among other things, you had a declaration just this past April by the Biden administration that the mass slaughter of Armenians at the hands of Ottoman Turks about a century ago was a genocide. That does not sit well with the Erdogan government, and a whole host of other things. Again, as you said, this is a country that's still part and parcel of the NATO alliance. So what does that mean to have a country that has been more and more illiberal recently, supposing to be part of an alliance that stands for a set of transatlantic values? So I think those are the things to look for playing out, Sebastian.
I was struck, you know, recently you were talking about 9/11, and then you pivoted to the cyber threat from Russia. FBI Director Christopher Wray was comparing the threat from ransomware, you know, much of which seems to be sponsored by Russia or at least hosted by Russia, to the threat from 9/11.
Having been in a state affected by the attack on the largest pipeline in the eastern seaboard states in the U.S., I can tell you it was pretty chilling to see the lines of people. I mean, certainly of a different nature, but still chilling to see the lines of people outside gas stations and then gas stations going empty. That was the case in retrospect for only a couple couple of days, but you had a subsequently large ransomware attack on a major meat processor. And these are sort of indications, I think, of capability. And there are other capabilities out there. There are all sorts of ways that, you know, the country can be meddled with and could really pose problems for the economy, but also more and more to security. So I think the cyber 9/11 is something that's been out there that security officials have been really concerned about. And we're now seeing some elements of this play out, or at least capabilities, Sebastian.
One more thing, Bob, on NATO, which I'm curious about. Do you see NATO as an important part of a Western response to China? Or is the traditional North Atlantic focus such that it really isn't?
That's an interesting you bring that up, because that is a new element that will probably get more discussion than it ever has at a NATO summit. And again, Jens Stoltenberg, in his discussions in Washington, did bring up China quite a bit, mentioned its major defense spending surge, and the fact that it too is involved in sort of cyber misbehavior, shall we say, but also its assertiveness in its own region, and just sort of steep concerns about what China aims to do with its powerful economy, its increasingly powerful military, it's ramping up its nuclear capabilities. So I think you're going to see a lot of talk about China. It will be interesting for me to see whether, to the extent to which the discussion bundles China together with Russia. China and Russia have made common cause increasingly in a number of areas, but there's a number of experts say it's really going too far to say they're part of any sort of bloc that we have to counter. But they do act in concert in certain ways, and have even gone as far as holding defense, you know, exercises and so forth. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see the scope of the concern on that issue. And I think we're going to be talking about China a little bit further in this podcast as well.
China will not go away as an issue. We'll have to keep an eye on that.
Well, and I think the very next summit, so here we've gone from US, UK, G7, NATO. Well, guess what? There's a EU summit also taking place in Brussels. That'll be June 15th, I believe, Sebastian. I think it's, according to some reports, the first of its kind since 2014. Can you talk a bit about what we should look for at the US-EU summit?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is being billed as a chance to undo some of the distancing that went on between the EU and the US during the Trump years. If you recall, I mean, that was sort of a two-way sort of hate-hate relationship, in the sense that President Trump was highly critical of the European allies for failing to contribute enough to defense and to force them into more burden sharing, as the term goes. He repeatedly threatened basically to pull the security rug out underneath the European feet. So he was pushing for a change in the relationship. And then at the same time on the European side, there was a sense that, okay, so the United States really is not trustworthy. We can't rely on them. And so leaders such as Emmanuel Macron in France and Angela Merkel in Germany were talking very much more in terms of, you know, a Europe that sort of stands up for itself. And I think although that's the security side of the relationship, there was also a commercial and trade side to the same thing. So you've seen the European Union become increasingly aggressive in the way that it is willing to consider taxation of American multinational companies, especially tech companies, going after them for alleged antitrust violations. And there's this sort of theme that the chief regulator of American tech is weirdly the European Commission, because to the extent that US tech has business in Europe and the Europeans insist on various terms, they can push things which then basically US tech has to adopt globally. So there's this both strategic and economic rift. And I think this meeting on June 15th is the beginning of what will be quite a long drawn out attempt to repair some of that distancing. One of the first issues is going to be that the Europeans are very keen for the so-called Section 232 measures, where President Trump cited national security issues as a reason for imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum. The Europeans are very keen for those things to be wound back. So I think that's some of what's at stake. I'm not sure anyone's expecting resolution just in this meeting coming up next week, but I think it's part of a start.
Trade is certainly one of those areas you haven't seen a lot coming out yet from the Biden administration on. They've been obviously very busy on the coronavirus front, but also immediately rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement and seemingly through multilateralism are hoping to get into a discussion with the Europeans on some of these areas you mentioned, especially the tech disagreements. But it does seem like a testy area, as you note. And I'm wondering if you've seen any head scratching or any response on the European side to this phrase that we we've heard here, foreign policy for the middle class coming out of the Biden administration. It's like, is the foreign policy for the middle class something that people understand as code as, you know, Americans have to make sure that they have their domestic house in order and that globalization is not going to antagonize, voting public too heavily, or the country could see a reversion to further populism?
I think there's a general concern outside the United States that there is a sort of America first component in the Biden economic agenda and a sort of promise to work in favor of the American blue collar working class, which has been part of President Biden's political identity forever. That may play well politically, but if it's translated into all sorts of you have to buy from American suppliers type of conditions, that will obviously rankle with foreign allies who look to the US to be a kind of open commercial player and to provide a level playing field for foreign companies that might want to supply things to the US government. So I think we'll have to watch. I don't think that's a big issue at the moment in Europe, but I think depending on how the Biden administration implements some of the spending plans that are being put through the Congress right now, this may or may not turn out to be a bit of a sore point in the relationship between the US and Europe.
Yeah, and I think given the final summit on our list, there's going to be a stress on the Biden side to sort of emphasize the solidarity of these transatlantic gatherings, Sebastian.
Well, let's get to that last summit, which of course is the one in Geneva, right at the end of President Biden's 3-city trip. And that will be the one where he meets President Putin of Russia. So, Bob, the thing which I'm scratching my head about here is that if we go back a couple of months, President Biden imposed sanctions on Russia for meddling in US elections. But now he's meeting Putin. So he's both a hawk and a diplomat. What should we expect from that encounter next week?
It's a great question, Sebastian, because there's been a lot of discussion, and certainly on the U.S. side, whether it's from Republicans or Democrats, about whether or not the administration should be meeting with Russia at all. Some Republican critics have said we shouldn't award Putin with a visit until he's sort of altered his behavior. Others of a more realist bent would say, look, during the darkest days of the Cold War, the U.S. had summits with the Soviet Union. You have to continue to have conversations with the leadership, certainly of the world's two major nuclear powers, but also to obviously major powers to Security Council countries and so forth. As our colleague Steve Sestanovich wrote for our website this week, you got to set the expectation bar pretty low and sort of sort out what constitutes success here. And I think the very fact of them meeting is important, but with that has to come, the understanding that no sort of grand declarations of a reset or any sort of grand notions of an agreement, but more like, are there some basic things that the two sides can get together on? So some have pointed to the fact that, well, they can get an easy win by sort of reversing the trend on closing all these consulates in each country. I mean, I believe the U.S. doesn't have any other diplomatic presence outside of Moscow at this point. Things are so bad. And so can they get on an even footing where, the U.S. permits the opening up of Russian consulates in the U.S. and Russia does the same and they get their ambassadors back in these nations and, they sort of set up a basic even keel of diplomatic engagement in each other's countries. That's one thing. But I do think one of the big things to watch also is just sort of the frankness in tone and the willingness to be frank and tone with each other. You saw these very awkward public meetings, at least the way I saw it, and some other Russian experts that saw it when you had President Trump and Putin emerge from their meeting, especially in Helsinki. And there was no public challenging or rebuke of Russia for its meddling in the U.S. elections and its other cyber activities. Now, since then, you've had the famous SolarWinds hack, as you referred to previously, if not state-sponsored, then Russian-based hacking of a really dangerous nature. I think you're going to see some really sort of direct exchanges on this cyber behavior, Sebastian. And then you'll see Russian rebuking, in turn rebuking the U.S. for meddling in its affairs, whether it's, sort of NGOs that support democracy or support for Navalny, who the Russian state sees as a threat, Alexei Navalny, or other areas where Russia sees the Western alliances going too far. You'll see that kind of exchange happen. But I think it's going to be important for the two sides to find a few areas where they can also talk about some common cause. Maybe it's even in places like, discussing global climate agreements. Maybe it's a further addition to the nuclear diplomacy. They've kind of revived the New START process. Maybe it's on the Iran nuclear deal, which the Biden administration has now signaled it will rejoin and is involved in Vienna and negotiations with Iran. And Russia is definitely a part of that. Maybe it's opening up a humanitarian corridor in Syria to at least keep the flow of sort of life-saving aid to the people still dealing with some of the worst humanitarian situation in the world in Syria. It is areas like that they can at least talk about in person. You have to have these leaders who can can get together. Again, this in-person diplomacy really beats all of the Zoom diplomacy that we've seen over the last 16 months. And so I think this is an opportunity to just kind of lay down some markers, really. And I think both sides have talked about in various ways bringing some sense of stability and predictability. Although you have a number of critics of Russia saying Putin is not interested in predictability or stability. He's interested purely in undermining the West. So that's back to your original question, Sebastian. That question of can you find in Putin any sort of a partner on any issues of substance is going to be a question.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a underlying point about all this diplomacy, which is that we know we're coming against this very weird background, both because, you know, for 4 years, the United States had an administration that didn't really value or favor the traditional cultivation of alliances or the traditional sort of stance towards an autocrat like President Putin. So you had reversal on both those things. And, you know, we're just emerging from that now. And it takes a while to try to get back to where you were before. And then on top of that, of course, you've got the pandemic, which has completely interrupted the normal run of diplomatic interaction and has sucked up government's energies and quite rightly focused everybody on this one central issue of pandemic response, including the economic response to the pandemic. And so all this diplomacy has been frozen and in some periods double frozen. And we're emerging from that. So I'm very sympathetic to this argument that, look, just having a meeting is a sign of thaw, a sign of progress, and is laying the basis for future cooperation. You can't work together on practical issues until you've actually met each other. I do think, though, that the difference between making this sort of argument on the G7 and making this sort of argument on Putin is precisely what you just said, Bob, namely, there is a theory of the case with Putin that his interest is to be a disruptor. It's precisely not to stabilize the relationship and make himself predictable or cooperative. He gets all his leverage and almost his sense of identity from being difficult.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, Sebastian, I think that sums it up well, that he's got domestic constituents too, even though as an authoritarian leader, he can set the tone in a different way than a democratic leader can. He, as some have argued, you know, is able to make great domestic leverage out of, having the United States as the heavy, and his ability to stand up to the United States allows Russia to say it is a major world player with a global role. And it's just a question of how he wants to maneuver that. So as much remains to be seen in Geneva, maybe it's just a starting point again.
Well, there'll be more opportunities on this podcast for people to be listening to all this stuff as it unfolds. But I think this emergence from the frozen world of the last 4 years is going to be fascinating diplomatically to watch. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Israel's emerging government faces a special confidence vote in the Knesset. And the anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando is marked.
Please subscribe to The World next week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review. While you're at it, please. They really help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlich. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Sebastian Malaby saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying, Sebastian, thanks as always for joining, and so long out there.